Full night of playoff action here in the NBA. We had two mediocre games and then a really fun one right at the end. We're going to cover all three for you.
I take exception to the mediocre comment, but that's okay. G-leaguers are getting a big raise.
And we've got all you need to know for Wednesday's night's action in the NBA playoffs here on the Wednesday edition of Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Locked On NBA, the daily podcast covering everything you know need to know about the association. As always on Wednesdays, I'm Jake Madison, at Nola Jake on Twitter, editor over at LockedOnPelicans.com, credential member of the media and Pelicans insider.
And I'm John Corrales, co-host of the Locked On Celtics podcast at Reds_Army_John on Twitter. And I am the co-founder of RedsArmy.com and a contributor to the Boston Celtics coverage on Boston.com.
And there was a busy night of action here in the association when we get the playoffs going. So we're just going to dive right on into everything. First game of the night, Toronto 130, Washington 119. John, this one's summed up by the picture that you sent me of just the sad Washington Wizards on the bench. So before we even talk about any of this, which sad Wizard are you?
I've been thinking about this for way too long. First of all, shout out to Ben Golliver for the photo. I think I might be Martian Gortat because I'm definitely not John Wall, because I feel like John Wall is just trying to dominate everything in that photo. I'm not sure if I'm Beal, because just Beal is so resigned to death in that photo. I feel like Gortat is just like, what more do you want me to do? So I don't know. It's just all bad. It's all bad for the Wizards. They are in just, they're a mess. And for me, the Wizards, the narrative of they don't like each other and why they were better without Wall for a stretch and that whole everybody eats thing, I think it was all just summed up in that photo. So I feel like I'm Gortat because it sums up the frustration in Washington, because he's just like trying to explain certain things to Wall and nothing is getting through.
No, I feel like I'm Beal in this one. If I were a Wizards fan, I'd do what Beal does. Just put your head in your hands, not talk to anyone, and just try and get away from this all. Maybe imagine yourself on a beach in some nice relaxing area with like a frozen drink in your hand, because that's where they're really going to be in a short period of time.
Can I say I was listening to the crossover between Locked On Wizards and Locked On Pacers, and just listening to the resignation from Wizards fans, and it just feels like Raptors. It feels like Wizards fans are just like, yep, this is about right, and this all feels terrible, and this whole season feels terrible, and There's no, I think, redeeming qualities. If you're a Wizards fan, what redeeming quality to this season is there? No. After losing this game, it feels like a lot of the crap that's been talked by the Wizards, you know, specifically John Wall, to a lesser degree Bradley Beal, the fans are just like, no, I'm not buying into any of this stuff. I think they're all ready for this to go away.
This was weird. This was a very strange game, and I have no idea what Brooks was doing with his rotations. You had Wall and Beal pick up two fouls, and then he just sat them and went completely away from the rotation that's at least gotten them to the postseason. When those two guys aren't foul prone, so why do you really need to sit them and not roll with them longer and play into Toronto's deep bench and give them even more of an advantage? You had Wall play for 11 and a half minutes in the first half, Beal for 13 minutes, 20 seconds. And then you go down 18. Like, what are you doing in this one?
But here's, to me, the Toronto was doing all of their damage against the starters. They came out to a huge early lead. Watching the beginning of that game, the Wizards didn't get to any of the 50-50 balls. Toronto got every easy shot that they wanted. The reason why Washington was even in the game at all, Ty Lawson of all people came
in. That shouldn't be happening at this point for the Wizards.
Mike Scott was carrying the Wizards. He was the redemption. I saw Wizards fans tweeting, like, please, more Mike Scott. And then Wall and Beal came in again, and everything fell apart. So we can question what Brooks was doing, and I don't think Brooks is surviving. Hell, they'd probably fire him now if they could, but he's definitely not coming back next season. I'd be shocked.
No, it was a weird one. Wall did play a little bit better in the second half, finished with 29 points on the night. But when you're getting 14 from Ty Lawson and 20 from Mike Scott, like, your season's gone wrong, and that's not how this should be in the postseason whatsoever. And there's a reason that, you know, the Toronto just went on to win. And this is a different Toronto team, isn't it? In years past, you feel like when the Washington Wizards made that run, they would have just folded. But they kind of held strong. And, man, DeMar DeRozan, big night, 37 points from him.
Beast. I mean, he's just out there just crushing it. I know Lowry wasn't great overall. He was great early. Valanciunas was huge down the stretch, hitting threes. I mean, he had a monster game, 19 points, 14 rebounds. It is a different Toronto team, and I think when you get guys like Miles scoring 18 off the bench, that bench play is so huge. Wright giving you 11 points off the bench. They are continuing to do what they've done throughout the regular season. They get good play from their starters, and then their bench comes in and really just dominates other benches and has done a really good job. Not maybe great right now, and with Van Vliet not at 100% here, it's maybe not exactly what we're going to see moving forward. But Toronto has kind of grown as an offensive unit. They've grown into a new type of offense. You know, you've got Dwayne Casey kind of accepting. And the crux of the Dwayne Casey Coach of the Year argument is that he got the team to play differently. Some of the blowback against that is that he's gotten the team to play the way the rest of the NBA has played. But regardless, it's a new Raptors team that's taking threes. I mean, DeMar DeRozan took six three-pointers.
This is just different
for
him. He took
six three-pointers in this game, and he hit three of them. It's just huge. It's just so the evolution of the Raptors has been very big, and maybe the devolution of the Wizards, it plays into this as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a moment here after we talk about New Orleans and Portland, but we're going to save that one for last since we're just going chronologically in order here. So next up on the list, I'm going to let you really focus on this one. 120, the Boston Celtics, 106, the Milwaukee Bucks. What happened in this one?
Well, what happened was Jaylen Brown went supernova. I mean, that dude went nuts for a 30-point game, and he really carried the Celtics early on. So in game one, Al Horford was the big monster, getting a lot of post touches and really dominating in the post. But Jaylen Brown came in this game and really just was hot right away. So Brown's numbers, 30 points on 12 of 22 shooting, and he just was a force in the first half. And then Terry Rozier, beyond Jaylen Brown, has been a revelation in the postseason. And he attacked Giannis Antetokounmpo. He was hitting threes. And the number, I think, there's two numbers here that explain this series from the Boston perspective. Boston's starting backcourt, Terry Rozier and Jaylen Brown, versus Tony Snell and Eric Bledsoe. The Celtics backcourt has outscored Milwaukee's backcourt 96-25 through two games in this series. Rozier and Brown have just been monsters. Eric Bledsoe has been nowhere to be found. Tony Snell does not even exist. And then the bench scoring, is 68-48 throughout this series in Boston's favor, which means huge production for Marcus Morris. And basically, the Celtics have gotten monster performances from everybody they've needed to get monster performances from. So Rozier, Jaylen Brown, Al Horford, Jason Tatum, who didn't have a great offensive game tonight, but has still produced and has been playing great on both ends. Marcus Morris coming off the bench. We had a huge Shane Larkin game. He was very, very productive and hit a buzzer beater before the half to push a Celtics lead to 15 going into halftime. And on the other side, Milwaukee has just been, for lack of a better term, stupid.
I don't know what they're doing there. It's you had that the technical on Bledsoe. You had him do the foul with like 0.8 left, and then there's just no one there other than Chris Middleton and Giannis. Middleton had 25 points. You had Giannis with 30, but you don't get much from anyone else. Jabari Parker, their third best player, basically is playing 10 minutes in this game because he can't do anything right and plays no defense. Also, it sounds like we should probably know Terry Rozier's name.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You should know Terry Rozier's name, even though after the game, Bledsoe pretended not to know Rozier's name. But look, I'll just give a shout out to my Locked On Celtics podcast. I went off on Bledsoe on the Locked On Celtics podcast because after the game, a reporter asked Bledsoe what if he took that matchup personally against Rozier, and he said, who? And they said, Terry Rozier. And he says, I don't know who that is. Or with an added expletive.
It's the most played out trash talk.
Right. But there's nobody on this earth that should be trash talking Terry Rozier less than Eric Bledsoe. Rozier put Bledsoe on skates and hit a shot in game one with 0.5 left. And it was only through the miracle of Chris Middleton that shot isn't part of the overall NBA consciousness right now. And that he's lucky that game went into overtime. But even in this game, Bledsoe, 5 of 13 shooting, 12 points. Rozier, 8 of 14 shooting, 23 points. 8 assists, 1 steal. No turnovers. Rozier has not turned the ball over in either of these two games. And I think that's the most important statistic of this series. More than Al Horford doing what he's done, more than the Celtics. I know Antetokounmpo's offensive numbers, if you look at the box scores, are super, super impressive. But he has not dominated the series. More than any other statistic, the Milwaukee Bucks succeed through their length in the half court, deflecting the ball and getting out in transition. That is where they
need, that's where they need to do most of their scoring from, and they're not able to force Boston to turn that ball over enough to really take advantage of that at all. Boston only had 7 turnovers on the night.
Right. The Celtics have only done that in 8 quarters of this series. They did it in the second quarter of game one, and they were destroyed in that quarter. Every other quarter, they have avoided that, and Rozier having 0 turnovers, filling in for Kyrie Irving, that is the most important statistic of this series. And if he can continue, obviously he's not going to go the entire series without a turnover, but if he only turns it over a couple times here and there for the rest of this series, I think my prediction of Celtics in 6 will come to fruition. He has been absolutely amazing. Meanwhile, from the Bucks' perspective, Parker, just a ghost. Snell, a ghost. Bledsoe, a ghost. And if you go into the series with Giannis Antetokounmpo and Chris Middleton combining for 55, but then getting matched basically by Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier combining for 53, then you don't have a prayer. And they'll be lucky if this goes 6.
Yeah, and so these first two games of the night were home teams taking care of business where they needed to. But then we hit the third game, the one that's near and dear to me here, with New Orleans going on the road, stealing game 2, now up 2-0 in the series on Portland, 111-102. This was a really fun game, first and foremost. And My goodness, was New Orleans was in control of this one for a while behind stellar play from Drew Holiday, who finished with 33 points on the night, but his defense has been absolutely amazing on Lillard and McCollum in this one. Anthony Davis woke up a little bit in the second quarter after a quiet first. He took kind of charge of this one, 22 points. New Orleans looked like they were going to run away from this, but finally, for the first time in this series, Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum started scoring a little bit in the second half to really make this one close, and then it just went back and forth right at the end. So this is probably an unfair question to ask, but has Drew Holiday been the best player in this series, or at least the best guard?
I mean, how can you say not? I mean, he's just been a monster. The game he had clutch play after clutch play after clutch play. And if you look at the numbers, there's nobody that compares to what Drew Holiday did in game two here. He has been just dominant. Now, I will throw a little love towards playoff Rondo.
And well, I saw him come up in the fourth here, and we can keep talking about him, but so for the final 16 minutes of this game, Anthony Davis didn't have a point, didn't make a shot, and it had to be other guys stepping up, and Rondo was really one of them.
Yeah. Playoff Rondo is just amazing. Now, I've seen playoff Rondo as a member of the Celtics, and I've seen playoff Rondo as a member of the Bulls last year against the Celtics, and now seeing him do it again for the Pelicans, he just finds a way to be awesome in the playoffs. I don't want to drive the conversation away from Holiday, because Holiday deserves all of the love. I just am so partial to Rondo in these situations that I feel like he's just one of those genius type of players. He is absolutely, when it comes to basketball, the smartest person not even in the room on the planet. He's just a savant when it comes to basketball. And I think he gets so bored with the minutia of so many regular season games that when it comes to this, he steps his game up to nearly get a triple-double in this situation. He finds guys. I forget who he found underneath for a clutch basket.
It was Holiday.
It was a Holiday.
Threw this needle pass from basically the sideline.
Stupid angle. I don't even know how he made that pass.
Got in there, and I have no idea how he made the pass. And I have no idea really how Drew Holiday scored between like three guys to do it. Holiday's just—you could go on and on and on about him in this series. And look, I'll admit it first and foremost. I was blasting the contract that the Pelicans gave him this past summer, but I've been blown away by what I've seen. This is a guy who should be first team all defense. If you were to factor in playoffs, maybe you could make a claim for not first team all NBA, but maybe making an all NBA team. He's been that good at times this year, particularly with DeMarcus Cousins going down. And who thought New Orleans was going to go on the road and win these two games? Now coming back home, looking to potentially close out this series, and they've played tremendously. This game did swing a little bit after the first half, where you had Al-Farouq Aminu hitting three-pointers. He hit four in the first half. Once he cooled off, and the New Orleans plan of just trying to get the ball out of Damian Lillard and McCollum's hands was really big, and they kind of slowed down. New Orleans took control of this game. Big for Portland was Mo Harkless coming back. He played 27 minutes on the night, 11 points. They're going to really need him, because the one area that maybe they don't match up very well with New Orleans doesn't match up with them with, is on the wing. You saw too many minutes from Solomon Hill. Darius Miller isn't going to get it done there. And Etuan Moore, who starts at the three for the Pels, has a lot of trouble guarding guys taller than him. He's serviceable, and when you have him on McCollum, he does some just dirty work to kind of keep McCollum from getting the ball and scoring. But Harkless there can potentially make some matchup problems. And also, once Yusuf Nurkic went out injured, he only played 15 minutes tonight, the game just broke wide open for the Pelicans. They were screening high in the high pick and roll with Nurkic and Lillard to pull Anthony Davis out of the paint, and it was allowing them to get just offensive rebound after offensive rebound, 13 for Portland, and the Pelicans were struggling there to try and limit those second chance points. Once he goes out, the complexion of the game changed. New Orleans seized control, and then to go 16 minutes without Anthony Davis scoring is a rather impressive thing. And now they get to go home to New Orleans, where I am excited to see some playoff basketball.
Yeah, that's going to be fun for you. I really think tonight what we saw might be the complete implosion of two teams that we thought were going to be a lot better than what they are. Now, Portland with McCollum and Lillard It's a really, obviously really good team. They won 48 games this year. The Wizards, obviously they had injury problems. They didn't finish as high as they'd like to, but they are two teams that are completely hamstrung by their salary cap numbers. They are just in tough situations. They both got amazing offensive backcourts, but they are in similar situations. And this is a topic that we will tackle much more as the off season continues, but we now have the Wizards down 2-0, Portland down 2-0, two capped out franchises who are in really no position to make any real moves. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what the Blazers and the Wizards choose to do this offseason.
Portland's been ducking the tax as much as they can for the past number of years. I think they're just below it right now, but I might be wrong on that. Is this a team worth going into a tax for?
No, like, no, not
it's
at
definitely
all.
Not. You don't. Not you're at you're all. In a smallish market. I know they've got tons of money, but you still don't want to spend it on something like this when you're not necessarily going to be a contender. So they've got a dilemma.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I don't want to overstate everything, but like Evan Turner's contract is an albatross. Like they are stuck. They are really in a bad place.
The Pelicans dared him to shoot. Anytime he got the ball, they just backed away. They did what, you know, the Pelicans did to Lonzo Ball and other teams have done to Lonzo Ball, which is you do your thing. And he couldn't beat him. You don't want to be paying that much money to that dude at all when you're trying to compete for a title. There's a very obvious way to beat you offensive or defensively that way.
Yeah, and we didn't see him on the floor for when's the last time we saw him on the floor in the second half, like in the fourth quarter? Like I didn't see him on the floor anywhere down the stretch. Like, and you need it if you're paying that guy that much money. I don't want to go into, you know, money versus performance, but like that's when you're in this situation, like that's a guy you need. You need a guy that makes that takes up that much of your cap to be at least on the floor. So it was just very. They're stuck. They're stuck.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. So it's not really the too long didn't watch tonight, since there were only three games and they're all playoff games, and we're all sure you watched, but we're glad you listened to the recap to keep you up on everything that's going on in the NBA. And don't forget, Locked On NBA is 5 days a week now, so make sure you listen and subscribe to catch up on everything going on around the association. So some news coming out for the G League today in what I think is a pretty interesting story. They're getting raises, 35% to be exact, going up from $26,000 to $35,000. That's going to be a big deal for the G League and kind of legitimizing it and maybe making it a farm system.
Yeah, the G League is – I have a lot of thoughts about the G League and too many for this particular segment, but ultimately – I think the NBA needs to make the G League a legitimate minor league where the players in the system are both adequately paid, which this is a step, but let's be honest, this is a step that puts them in line with the guys who play video games in the 2K League. And I think the biggest problem here is these guys are getting $35,000, and it's fine that they're getting this money. They also get their health benefits paid for. They also get housing. They also get a travel stipend. So
it's only 5 months, so you got to keep that in mind too.
Right. So they can go and they can play elsewhere, and $35,000 ends up being basically, you know, somewhere in the $70,000, and the two-way contracts go up and blah, 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 blah. The biggest problem here is NBA teams do not want to invest in the G League because the salaries that we're talking about here, that the $35,000 is if you or I got a tryout and they said, yeah, you're going to make this G League team. Here's $35,000 for 5 months. But you're basically still an NBA free agent. So me, as a Celtics guy, the main Red Claws decide to sign Jake Madison and say, okay, we like what you've got to offer. We're going to bring you in. You're an NBA free agent. You signed directly with the main Red Claws. We can pay you money to develop you, And then the Pelicans can come in and be like, hey, Jake Madison, we really like how you've been doing with the Celtics affiliate.
Guy, basically. And yeah, they're not the ones, they're not reaping the benefit of the investment that they're putting
exactly.
in. And the way to fix that is you got to get an affiliate for all 30 teams and they keep the guys on there. And it's as simple as that. I think one of the things they also need to start dealing with and start looking at is to not worry about making money off of the G League and looking at it as a business and wondering if it's going to be profitable or not, and just put these teams close to home, even if you have to maybe take them away from these other cities, have them play their games. I think in the NBA, like, practice facilities would be a cool draw for fans to go and watch them there. And I think that's how you almost need to do this. Just keep them close to home, have them practice with the parent club, some of these guys. I think that goes a long way towards everything. And as it's set up right now, yeah, you know, Twitch and the G League and the esports and everything is going to make way more money from all of that. So you're going to pay those guys more. But if you want this to be taken seriously, yeah, you look, I'm a big video game guy and I believe in esports and everything here, but you still can't have those guys necessarily making more than the professional athletes.
No, not at all. Look, I grew up, I was born and raised in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Now, I say that because the Pawtucket Red Sox are the AAA affiliate of the Boston Red Sox. So I grew up on baseball. And I really believe in the baseball minor league system, which is significantly different and in no way can really be compared to the basketball system, except that, to your point, having a close to home team actually increases the investment. And if you are so, like, the Celtics are doing it right, and they're one of many teams doing it right. Like, the Knicks have the Westchester Knicks. So you have the New York Knicks and Manhattan, and Westchester is on the Metro North Railroad 40 minutes away. And the Celtics are in Boston, and they have the main Red Claws in Portland, Maine, which is a couple of hour drive away. So you have a team that's within the metro area, within the viewing area, within the place where a local cable subscriber can watch their team or go to that game and see, like, they saw Gershon Yabusele, who got 10 early minutes in a playoff game tonight. But you go to Maine and you see Gershon Yabusele get significant minutes in that game, and you can say, hey, I saw Gershon Yabusele in Maine. Now, me, as a Pawtucket guy, I say, I saw, like, Mo Vaughn play for the Pawtucket Red Sox, and then I saw him play first base for the Red Sox in Boston, and that just kind of makes you feel really, really good about sticking with your team. So I think having that local team is a very important thing, to your point. I think it's if every NBA team could have a local team where they develop their own talent somehow. And that goes hand in hand with, by the way, that one and done, eliminating that and getting guys out of high school and having a salary structure where you can bring guys in out of high school that maybe need a couple of years extra development. So you're not flooding them with money and having them flame out because they're not good enough. I think if you can develop that minor league system, have them engage with local fans, have them make more money, but not like super $1 million crazy contracts, and develop within the team system, within the team, you know, the offense and the defense that they're trying to run. It's all super important. And I think the NBA, the sooner they get to that type of system, the better.
Yeah, and I think this ties into something you and I talked about a couple weeks ago, actually, where the NBA is making recommendations for rule changes and kind of standards across the board, starting at a very young level to kind of build this up so that when these players are making the G League and potentially being fringe NBA guys, they've had kind of the right kind of training, which is going to help the G League be a much better product overall, which is going to be a big thing form. But you and I could probably go on for days about this because there's a lot of interesting ways you can look at this and a lot of changes, but unfortunately we cannot do that today because we got more playoff games. And before we get to that, again, make sure you subscribe to Locked On NBA Monday through Friday. No other podcast bringing you recaps like this, previews like this on a daily basis, and touching on all the topics you need to hear about the association. All right, John, three more big playoff games tonight, starting with the Pacers and Cavaliers. Game two after the Cavs were kind of stunned in game one.
Yeah, you know, look, I still feel like Indy played a perfect game. Cleveland played a decidedly imperfect game. I feel like LeBron, it was kind of like almost like an extension of the regular season for them. And they're like, oh, okay, it's just Indiana. We're going to kind of coast a little bit. And they got punched in the mouth, which is to Indiana's credit. Now, they need to definitely shore up a lot of the issues that they've had throughout, the defensive issues. I think in game two, LeBron will assert himself. And I just can't get away from the idea that LeBron is just going to take over, and regardless of all of the amazing things that Indy has done, and as awesome as Oladipo has been, I feel like LeBron is just going to be like, oh, all right, here we go. Let me just take care of this.
It's like a movie villain where you let the henchmen kind of do everything and then they fail and he's just, fine, I'll do it myself. And that's kind of what happened here in game one. He looked to get his teammates more involved and he wasn't as aggressive and as assertive as I think you're going to see him in game two. And I don't know, other than Oladipo, if Indiana has a way to get the ball out of his hands. Though Depot was tremendous in game one. Every time the Cavs didn't trap him or double team him or do anything to kind of force the ball away from him, he just went right at him. When you said it, they punched the Cavaliers in the mouth. He just went right at those bigs, took a step back, hit a jumper, and it was impressive. Defensively, they were very solid too. And I don't know if they're going to be able to quite do that again. I think we're probably going to see the Cavs even this series. And then moving on, we got the next matchup with Utah taking on OKC. You know, I thought maybe Utah should win this series, but then you kind of look at it and on paper, OKC kind of is a better team, right?
Yeah, they've got the better talent at least the top two positions. And Paul George, when he gets going like he did in game one, how do you stop that? And we're talking about the Thunder and Russell Westbrook. So we're looking at a series where the best player in the series isn't even Westbrook at this point. So I think Utah is susceptible to game planning out their biggest strength, which is Rudy Gobert. And unfortunately, in today's NBA especially, that big dominant center that has been the crux of Utah's success can be kind of, I guess, countered, for lack of a better term, if you got the right personnel and the right style. And you saw in game one at the end, like, Gobert had to come over and try to trap Paul George.
Yeah, and that's not what he's good at all.
That's
he needs to be defending the rim entirely.
Exactly. So when you run pick and roll against Utah, and I think this is the difference between regular season and postseason. In the regular season, everybody just does what they do best and hopes that that's good. And you have minor in-game adjustments, but really Utah just does what they do best. They drop Gobert in pick and roll coverage, and it's just defend the rim at all costs. In a playoff series, when you're sitting there at the end of a game where you think you have a chance to win, and you're like, shit, the only thing we can do is trap Paul George. And now, hey, Rudy, I know we need you to defend the rim, but you're our best defender and still athletic at your size. We need you to trap now. And it just is uncomfortable, and it changes the entire flow of the defense. And that's just too much. And so I trust Quinn Snyder, because he's a really good coach, to find a different approach to Paul George. But this might
it's a problem though. Like, you have a guy who went 8 of 11 from three in that game. And when he's doing that, one, what are you supposed to do? There's not really a whole lot. And then when you do trap him, don't forget there's Russell Westbrook who can get into the paint at ease. And if he just makes a quick pocket pass anticipating that trap that's coming, and he's a smart player, he did it. He just hits Westbrook and Westbrook goes. And what are you going to do there? There's not much else. And you need Gobert in the paint to take away Westbrook. And then there's Steven Adams, who's kind of a bit of a Gobert neutralizer and kind of the right type of center to push him out of the paint and create some space for these other guys.
Yeah, this is a monster game for the Jazz if they can't figure this out. And let's not even forget that you have Carmelo Anthony, who if he really just fully embraces that Olympic mellow style, and if he can get going a little bit, then there's just no chance. So I feel like Utah, this is a crucial game for Utah. Obviously, it's crucial for every team to not go down 2-0, but it's especially crucial for Utah because it's involving them getting out of their comfort zone. They need to find a way to kind of get back into that and get their defensive coverages. Because and let's not, we haven't even mentioned that Donovan Mitchell
has probably a good thing to throw in here.
Yeah, Donovan Mitchell has a toe that he's like, oh, it's no big deal, but he's been limited. If forget everything that we just said, if Donovan Mitchell isn't even 80%,
yeah,
then
they're
forget
cooked.
He's
so key to them, and he played so well in game one, but he's listed as questionable right now. He went through a limited practice on Tuesday. He's going to play. How effective will he be is the question. But also, you do have Paul George listed as questionable as well with a hip injury that he hit. I think it was late in the third or fourth. I can't remember. Yeah. And then immediately went out. But again, you know, if Mitchell's not carrying that scoring load for this team, they're going to struggle. And like you said, they're going to be out of their comfort zones a little bit, which then leads into the next game and a team out of their comfort zone. And game one was close between the Timberwolves and the Rockets. The Rockets only winning by three, but that was Minnesota's best chance and they blew it.
Yeah. Look, this is a super, super interesting series because you heard Chris Webber just going nuts about this in the broadcast. Like, why didn't Towns get more touches? But if you look at the way they ran their offense, I think they did what they were coached to do.
That's probably part of the issue, too, is coaching in this matchup just does not fit well against what the Rockets are trying to accomplish here.
Right. So, this can be an entire podcast on its own because the Wolves defended the Rockets, I think, the right way. They really dropped back. They stuck with the shooters. They challenged the shooters, and they didn't get too caught up in overly aggressively closing out and overselling defensively that way. They dropped back behind that and challenged at the rim, knowing, and I've said this a million times, that the Rockets, and I don't think the Wolves are necessarily the team to do this, but the Rockets are susceptible defensively because the Rockets offense is susceptible because they just so discard that mid-range. I look at the mid-range as a body shot in boxing that you still, regardless, even though you know you need to hit a guy in the jaw to knock him out, you still have to hit that body shot to lower the defenses so you can get
to
that
suck
shot
him out a little
head.
Bit. Yeah,
that's exactly it. So I think the Wolves have the right idea defensively. I just don't know that they have the right offense to counter what they do defensively and outscore the Rockets. And there's always the possibility of the Rockets just hitting those crazy shots. And they, despite it all, even saying that they had a good defensive game plan, James Harden was still hitting those step back threes.
He was
so
still doing all
these, do. Like, what do you do about that?
Yeah, and then in this game, the final score is close, but then you kind of look at it and you rewatch it, and you had Houston go 10 of 37 from deep. That's 27%. They're not going to shoot that poorly. You're not going to have Ariza go 0 for 4, P.J. Tucker 1 of 5, Chris Paul 1 of 6, Eric Gordon 1 of 7. You know, you're not going to have guys that are shooting 20% and less in this series. And Minnesota couldn't get things going offensively. You couldn't slow Harden down, really. One, you had Jimmy Butler on him, and he still put up 44 points on you. So what are you supposed to do there, then, if you can't even slow him down with that? And, yeah, I get what you're saying about Towns, but he had a usage rate of 14.1%. He took 9 shots. Like, you've got to try something to get some offense going on. You got to just let him cook down low and see if he can take Capella. Also, if you get Capella in foul trouble, all of a sudden, that Houston pick and roll game, which they generate so many three-pointers off of, is not nearly as effective, because you're just going to clamp down on the shooters then, because Harden has no role man to dump the ball off to on a lob. And they had their chance in game one to kind of do all of this, and it didn't work. And Houston's going to, you know, they'll regress here, and they're going to hit more of their three-pointers, regress to the mean on that. And this series is probably over at this point.
Yeah, 100% agree on that, especially with Capella. Like I've said before, I call Capella like the puzzle piece. Like, he's the guy that completes the picture. And I think one of the things that makes Harden so effective is that he is able to do things at the last, very last possible instant that you don't expect. And many of those are alley-oops in the middle of the lane to Capella. Harden is amazing at, in the middle of traffic, throwing, you think he's going up for a lefty layup, but it's actually a lefty alley-oop.
Yeah, just that little move he does.
Yeah, and Capella's just all of a sudden flying down the lane because Harden's gravity has sucked in two or three defenders, and Capella comes flying down, and instead of a layup off the rim, he just adjusts the angle and throws it to the front of the rim, and Capella's in for an alley-oop. And if you can get Capella out, then that is gone. So yeah, it is imperative on Minnesota to make the adjustment. Now, going back to the coaching point that I made, the coaching point is that even with Towns on a mismatch down low on the block, they still want him to spread out because he's also one of their best shooters. So, but in that situation, you got to say, screw what we've done in the past. We've got to get him on the block because he's also got that opportunity to cook on the block and draw fouls and be a problem down there. And you have to just be willing to change some of the things that maybe that got you here, because the change is going to give you a better opportunity to win. And it's just on Thibodeau to get out of his own way and stop being so hard-headed and make that adjustment.
And that, for that guy, is probably easier said than done.
Definitely.
But this is an important slate of games. So some of the numbers, just so before we wrap everything up here, teams that go up 2-0 in a series, I think they win 93% of the time. So all of these teams are going to try and either even the series or get ahead to know that they have a stranglehold on this. So that's going to do it for the Wednesday edition of Locked On NBA. As always, I'm your host, Jake Madison, at Nola Jake on Twitter, and the editor over at LockedOnPelicans.com.
And I'm John Corrales, at RedsArmy_John on Twitter. I am the co-founder of RedsArmy.com and a contributor to the Boston.com Celtic coverage.
So make sure you always listen and subscribe to Locked On NBA 5 days a week. And we'll both be back with you all next Wednesday.